As Peter outlined last week, we've started a new series called The Kingdom of God is Like... To see what we can discover about the message of good news which Christ presented to his audience. As a youngster, I was told that a parable is an earthly story with a heavenly meaning, which frankly didn't help much. What are parables? Why did Jesus use this particular type of presentation? And what does this particular Bob the Builder story mean for us today? Somebody, when the Beatles were first on the pop scene, said 20 years from now, their songs will be forgotten. How wrong can you be? If Jesus had left huge volumes of writings in complex theological language, perhaps only university scholars would bother with them. But instead, 2,000 years later, the stories of the Good Samaritan, the prodigal son, and many others remain as relevant today as in first century Palestine. Rather than unfold a long dissertation on loving your neighbor, he tells of a Jew being shown kindness by a despised member of a minority group. Rather than give a long sermon about divine love, he tells of a father's undying love for a waste of space who happened to be his son. Throughout the history of man, storytellers have held audiences of both adults and children enthralled, fascinated, and yes, entertained. Is it any wonder that Jesus used such a method, among others, to get his message across? Last week we learnt that parables are like coded messages which need unlocking. But you'll remember that after the story that Jesus told about the sower, the disciples asked for the code. And he went to great lengths to explain the meaning of the parable. Now, some scholars have found this all too simple, all too straightforward. The brilliant Bible scholar Augustine said the story of the Good Samaritan was the story of fallen man Adam being rescued by the Good Samaritan, who's Jesus Christ, being taken to an inn, which is the church, and the innkeeper is none other than Paul himself. Does that sound right? No, in some senses, though perplexing, that doesn't sound like the sort of mind games we need to play with a parable. You'll also remember that the teacher of the law who heard this story as a response to "Who is my neighbor?" understood Christ's meaning only too well. So in some cases, even for us, the difficulty is not understanding the story, but, as always, putting it into practice. Some of my clever books tell me that the Aramaic word methyl, which in Greek is translated parabolae, which in English is parable, covered a whole range of figures of speech, including riddle and puzzle. Hence, speaking in parables was part of the riddle or puzzle of his ministry. So people heard, and they sometimes understood, but in many cases it made no impact on their lives. It's a bit like telling a joke. If you get the joke, you get the joke. But if you start analysing and explaining the joke, well, don't bother, because it becomes unfunny. It's been said that the nearest Jesus got to a joke was in saying, "It's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle. Some describe the small door in the larger door of the entrance to Jerusalem and said, oh yes, what he meant was the camel has a hard job to get through that little door. Reverend David Pawson was serving with the RAF as a chaplain in the Middle East, and he told the story of the camel to some Bedouin Arabs. And the response was, the Bedouin Arabs fell about laughing, absolutely tears running down their face. They saw the joke. Camel, eye of a needle. A rich man into the kingdom, camel, eye of the needle. Now please note also that a parable isn't just a visual aid to emphasize a particular idea. Its function is to provoke a response. These are not simply children's fairy tales. They are the punchline. They are the challenge. And they produce a reaction. But what of this parable? As we heard for the children, Bob the Builder and Ben the Builder. Again, in my early years, I was taught this is incredibly simple. If a man trusts in Christ, there is a safe, eternal future. If he refuses to turn to Christ, all is lost. Yes, this is a story of individual conversion and the consequent stability of faith when based on Christ, the Rock of Ages. But I think we need to look a little further. Chapters 5, 6 and 7 of Matthew, starting with the Beatitudes, include most of what we now call the Sermon on the Mount. Prior to chapter 5, we find that Jesus had been teaching in the synagogues, preaching the good news of the kingdom and healing every disease and sickness among the people. News about him spread all over Syria, and people brought to him all who were ill, and he healed them. Large crowds from Galilee, Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and the region around Jordan followed him. And when he saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and began to teach them. In a natural Olympic stadium, they came to hear a man who demonstrated time and time again that he was bringing the kingdom of heaven down to earth. And what does he talk about? First of all, the Beatitudes. About being salt and light. About the fulfillment of the law. About the need for a new understanding of God's law. Love your enemies. Don't make a self-righteous show of your religion. Don't judge others. Ask, seek, knock, and much, much more. And finally, after that long session, he ends with, therefore, anyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on a rock. Tiny story, and he finishes. And what happens? What happened when Mo Farah, Peacock and Weir finished their races? Recognizing that message is a paraphrase rather than a translation, let me read these words. When Jesus concluded his address, the crowd burst into applause. They'd never heard teaching like this. It was apparent that he was living everything he was saying. Quite a contrast to their religious teachers. This was the best teaching they had ever had. It's never occurred to me that a crowd would have applauded. But having recently experienced a crowd in East London at the Paralympics of 80,000 applauding, it gives me a shiver down my spine to think of the saints and angels right now praising, yes, applauding. So next time you read the angels in heaven rejoice over one sinner who repents. Just imagine what heavenly applause must be like. So wise man, foolish man. The Old Testament is constantly on about wisdom. Solomon prayed for it. The Psalms are full of it. Proverbs goes to great lengths to differentiate between wisdom and foolishness. Listen to this in Job. There's a mine for silver and a place where gold is refined. Iron is taken from the earth and copper is smelted from ore. Man puts an end to the darkness. He searches the farthest recesses for ore in the blackest darkness. Far from where people dwell, he cuts a shaft. In places forgotten by the foot of man, far from men, he dangles and sways. The earth from which food comes is transformed below as by fire. Sapphires come from its rocks, and its dust contains nuggets of gold. The bird of prey knows that hidden path. No falcon's eye has seen it. Proud beasts do not set foot on it, and no lion prowls there. And so he goes on, and then he says, but where can wisdom be found? Where does understanding dwell? And then he spends the rest of a long chapter again describing how silver and gold is brought out of the depths, but even where gold is, where is wisdom? And then at the end he says, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to shun evil, that is understanding. Read Proverbs 8 and you find a female figure called Wisdom who seeks to advise mankind of the necessity of following God. So Jesus is drawing on a rich vein of biblical truth when he describes a man with wisdom and a man without. James says, if any of you lack wisdom, he should ask of God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to him. So what is a wise man to do? He is to hear the words of Jesus and put them into practice. Simple, but profound. A human life needs to be built on the foundation of the teaching of Christ. The new kingdom of heaven on earth was to be built on the words of Christ. As we heard earlier in Luke, we find the wise man had to dig deep down to find the rock. The foolish man thought it was too much effort and would take too long. Notice also that the wise man and the foolish man did not escape the storms. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against the house. But unlike the foolish man, his house did not fall. The houses may have looked identical. You couldn't tell the difference between them. But without a firm foundation, disaster ensued when only sand lay under the house. Over the centuries, empires have built their foundation on sand. Take three 20th century examples. Fascism. Built on the belief that a super race of humans would achieve by violence and torture and killing a new world that would last 1,000 years. Communism, built on the hope that when the proletariat owns the means of production and all were equal in status, utopia would follow. Capitalism. I'm at present reading Andrew Marr's A History of Modern Britain, and he writes in his introduction, the big theme of this story is the defeat of politics by shopping. Consumerism has shouldered aside other ways of understanding the world, real political visions, organized religion, a pulsing sense of national identity. Though, of course, since he wrote that, we've had the Royal Jubilee, Olympics and Paralympics. Shopping, capitalism, the idea that consumerism will save our souls is an idea built on sand. If Zorba the Greek drops a euro coin in Athens, the sound is heard in Brussels, London, and even Washington, D.C. All built on sand. Last Tuesday, the 11th of September, 74 years of Yardley Baptist history were completed. YBC has its foundation in Jesus Christ. Speaking at the opening of the first church building over just over that, behind this wall in October 1948, Reverend S. Moon said, "A fine building such as this is necessary to worship, but the people who worship in it are the living stones built up into a spiritual home." And he added, "In these days, this is 1948, in these days we tend to sophisticate our Christianity. But conversion is fundamental, and he prayed that seeking souls might in this building find Christ, might be brought to a definite decision for him, and then express their relationship through believers' baptism." Every pastor we have had has emphasized a different aspect of Christ's teaching. But our future as a fellowship is not based on a foundation of tradition or regulation, but simply on the person of Jesus Christ. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 3, "For no man can lay any foundation other than the one already laid, which is Jesus Christ." Peter says in 1 Peter 2, "As you come to him, the living stone, rejected by men, but chosen of God and precious to him, you also, like living stones, are being built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, offering spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ." On Saturday, the 8th of September, just a few days ago, the leadership team sat in the sunshine outside the lounge for about 4 to 5 hours on a Saturday. We considered carefully our individual roles in the group. We began to put together ideas, yes, even building blocks for the future work at YBC. What I learned and what you already know is that we asked the Lord for a visionary to lead us into 2013. And the Lord sent us a man who fits that role. We wanted a team player, and he sent us a man who seems to find dealing with any age group a pleasure and has become a YBC family member in record time. Even the wise builder had to face storms and tempests, yet the house did not fall because its foundation was on the rock. We have a firm foundation. We have a God-given pastor. We have a leadership willing to listen and act. Consider this morning, if you wish, a 74th anniversary. Doesn't really matter what you call it. Will you with me this morning rededicate yourself to Jesus Christ? In response to the call, "Whom shall I send?" in Isaiah, "Who will go for us?" Simply reply, "Here am I, send me." I believe that 2013 will be a marvelous 75th year of blessing that God is just waiting to pour out on this fellowship and the people of Yardley. Don't miss out. The Lord wants you to be a participator and not a spectator. Take this personally this morning. What part does the Lord want you to play for the sake of his kingdom in the coming months? And the answer is between him and you. One of the features of our communion, which we'll come to soon, and I'd like to ask those serving to come forward,